Today on the 21st, Illinois is on track to later this month enter phase 4 of easing restrictions related to the coronavirus pandemic. But we'll talk with an Illinois biomathematician who says, not so fast. Then, as we confront racism in our society, younger generations will play a crucial role in building a more just and equitable future. That puts a lot of responsibility on parents, especially those of young children. We'll talk with a psychologist on how to talk to our kids about racism. And as more restaurant owners are turning to third-party delivery services like Grubhub and DoorDash to make ends meet during the pandemic, many have found them to be bad for business. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st, which is produced by Illinois Public Media and airs on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. Now news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. While the coronavirus has lost its place at the top of our headlines, it is still very real. The Illinois Department of Public Health has announced 625 new confirmed cases in Illinois. That's from yesterday afternoon, at least as we go to air Thursday morning, and 78 additional confirmed deaths. Overall, there have been nearly 130,000 known cases of the disease in Illinois and more than 6,000 deaths. It's in all but one county in the state. And the number of cases in Illinois may have peaked, but they're still on the rise in other parts of the U.S. Governor J.B. Pritzker said on Wednesday that Illinois is on pace to enter phase 4 of its plan to reopen by the end of the month after closures and restrictions on account of COVID-19. But our next guest is urging caution and says his forecast models suggest a much slower approach to coming out of lockdown. Olcay Akman is a professor of mathematics at Illinois State University and directs the Center for Collaborative Studies and Mathematical Biology. He's also editor-in-chief of the journal Letters of Biomathematics. Professor Akman, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
And as always, we want to hear from our listeners as well. Are you starting to venture out during phase 3, or maybe you're not ready to go sit on a restaurant patio yet or get a haircut at the barbershop or salon? We want to hear from you. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 800-222-9455. Phone lines are open at 800-222-9455. So, Professor Akman, when we think of the pandemic response, I think most people think of doctors or public health experts, but you're a mathematics professor. And can you talk a little bit about how math has been a critical part of understanding the coronavirus pandemic?
Yeah. Well, mathematical models consider collectively population characteristics, socioeconomic factors, and epidemiological mechanisms. For instance, estimation of the reproductive number at the start of the pandemic, initial exponential rise and doubling time, maximum number of cases, and time until that number is achieved. Impact of prevention programs such as mask use, social distancing, shelter in place, all go into models to help us learn about the disease spread characteristics. Basic human perception, on the other hand, tend to miss comprehensive understanding of the environmental and disease factors. Our minds tend to analyze differences rather linearly. How many infections were there yesterday? How many today? If the difference is not big, we tend not to be alarmed. So one important point I like to make, though, is it's important to keep in mind that mathematical models are not magic. Their results depend on whatever is fed into them. If the inputs are less precise, then the outputs will be obviously more erroneous.
You know, it's interesting you talk about thinking about it linearly. So, and you're right, I get these emails from the Illinois Department of Public Health every day. 625 new cases yesterday. It was 797 earlier in the week, and it was, 1,000 last week. And wow, that seems like probably, on the one hand, you could say that's great news, but it's still 625 more cases than we should have in an ideal circumstance without this disease, right? I mean, is that part of what you're talking about when we are sort of, most people think of things linearly?
Right. That's what our brains are trained to look at in differences in our environment. But as most infectious diseases, coronavirus also follows an exponential rise. So, for instance, if I'm capable of infecting two people, those two people go infect two people each, and then all of a sudden now there's four infected new, and then two that I infected and myself, so which gives rise to that exponential doubling.
So what does the math say about reopening now? Do you think we are easing restrictions too soon?
Well, availability of testing, vaccination, and contact tracing has not significantly changed to provide a major dent in the pandemic spread since we first implemented shelter-in-place policies in March. Again, having said that, I like to reiterate the purpose of a model is not to predict exact number of cases, but rather to evaluate the impact of competing interventions, such as what to open first, for instance, opening a school versus opening a hairdresser and so on. We still don't have anything different to substantially alter the initial predictions. For instance, we learned at the end of May that more than 200 schools in South Korea have been forced to close just days after they reopened due to a new spike in virus cases. 3 weeks after Arizona governor lifted his stay-at-home order, the state has seen a big spike in the number of coronavirus cases. The problem is, after easing restrictions, new spikes occur when we are still not better equipped to deal with the spread than 2-3 months ago. So in a way, yeah, I based on what we know so far, does not indicate that it's safe to abandon our initial policy decisions.
As I understand it, you are on a committee at Illinois State University. And what recommendations are you making there about the coming fall semester? And I wonder how that might differ from things that the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign should consider, or smaller liberal arts schools in other parts of Illinois, for example.
Yeah, gathering students from different parts of the country has certain risks, as opposed to, for instance, gathering people in a restaurant, because when a restaurant opens, the customers are mostly from the local area who were subject to the same preventive measures, same shelter at home policies, for instance. However, different states or countries have different preventive policies, some more loose than others, which may increase the risk. University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign has a bigger and more geographically diverse student population than, say, a small liberal arts college in a small town. So, but having said that, schools may approach reopening smartly, such as perhaps no use of elevators except for individuals with special needs, online instruction of the courses with high enrollment, weekly testing, use of large classrooms for small number of students, perhaps closing general places where students socially gather. So yes, I believe large universities with a geographically diverse student populations may have higher risk than smaller colleges with more local student populations. So my advice to the Illinois State University coming back policies will be will center around these ideas.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Uljai Akman, who's a professor of mathematics at Illinois State University and directs the Center for Collaborative Studies in Mathematical Biology there. And I want to remind you, you can join our conversation. Curious if you are venturing out into phase three, do you feel like you know, it's worth the risk to you, or are you sort of hanging back and letting other people take the chances? Give us a call, 800-222-9455. The number is 800-222-9455. And I also want to remind listeners that there is another way to join our conversation by text message. You can text the word TALK to 217-803-0730. And we got a message from someone identifying themselves as a doctor in Rockford, who says, acting like the virus is fake news or past us already will not make it disappear. If people cannot trust the news, then they need to be in contact with healthcare workers who have seen this horrible virus firsthand. And Professor Aukman, I wonder, you know, some people who have not had that direct experience with the virus are saying that maybe the precautions we took were a bit extreme. I've heard this referred to as the prevention paradox, because the outbreak wasn't, you know, as bad as it could have been. Some people think that we overreacted. And I wonder what you would say to people who might be thinking that.
Well, here's an example. In New York, the cases were on the rise for even after 3 weeks of strict lockdown. Individuals not showing symptoms are known to infect in this disease. For example, an infected but not symptomatic individual in China infected 7 people at a restaurant during a 2-hour lunch, even people sitting 14 meters apart. CDC has a report on this. So the preventive measures are one of the major reasons why most of us don't get to have a direct contact with an infected person. So no, I don't believe these measures were an overreaction.
Do you think we're going to see a spike in infections after the recent protests? And I mean, some of the biggest ones were well more than 7 days ago at this point, or even 10 days ago, I think, in Chicago. That was the weekend before last, when there were thousands of people massing downtown there. Do you think we will see a spike, or should we have seen a spike already, possibly?
Yeah, there is a higher likelihood that some clustering among the protesters might possibly contribute to further infections. However, we have also observed protesters wearing masks and maintaining proper distance on a continuous move, which may reduce the chances. It's known that not only the proximity, but also the duration of the contact and the use of preventive measures may have significant effect on the spread. As for the impact of the protests, I think we need to wait for a couple of weeks before we see any significant change in the disease spread behavior, because the way that the data are recorded and reported to national databases vary substantially among the communities. So for instance, if you look at the data, you'll see there aren't many infections reported on Sundays. That's not because the virus takes a day off, but that's because the people who do the paperwork, who collect the data and report the data to appropriate databases, are not at work. So I think in a couple of more weeks, we'll see if any change is related to the recent protests.
You know, and I guess you're right. As I think about it, I said 7 to 10 days is when the infection typically manifests itself. But I guess it was somebody at the protest who then spread it to, you know, say an older person in their household, then it might be another week or so after that before that particular infection manifested itself in a test. We've only got a few minutes left in our conversation, and I want to ask how this. You've studied other infectious diseases from a mathematical perspective. How is this coronavirus different than those?
There are a few major differences between coronavirus and other similar viruses. First of all, coronavirus is spread by droplets, which are heavier than aerosols that carry the common flu virus, but lighter than Ebola carrier, which is bodily fluids. So these aspects are critical for disease spread from infected individuals in its environment. COVID is found to be spread by presymptomatic stage individuals, unlike many other diseases where only symptomatic individuals spread the disease. For instance, measles is a good example of it. And last but not least, the mortality rate is much higher than other influenza-like illnesses.
And I just want to remind our listeners again, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Olcay Aukman, who's a professor of biomathematics. I think I said that right, at Illinois State University. And we got another text message in our text the 21st group. You can join that by texting the word talk to 217-803-0730. This message is from Rachel in Urbana, who says, I know people who think stage 3 means return to any normal activity you can, hang out with your friends, and relax. But Rachel goes on to say, in our household, we're living almost exactly the same way we have been for months. We may be more likely to go to a store to purchase something now instead of ordering online, but we're still wearing masks, avoiding proximity to other people, only shopping when necessary, etc. And Professor, in just about a minute left, we often ask our experts on the show about what they're doing personally when it comes to protecting themselves from the coronavirus. And I wonder when you will begin to start going to restaurant patios, if you're taking advantage of activities that are now allowed under phase three of the governor's plan to ease restrictions in Illinois.
I'm following Rachel's guidance until there's an extensive vaccination and or effective treatment in place. Social distancing is the only way to mitigate the COVID-19's impact. Coronavirus will be with us in the long term. It will get weaker. That's what viruses do to ensure their own survivability. Common sense social behavior, population contact tracing will be parts of our daily lives. So I personally still avoid restaurants. I still avoid grocery stores. But the way I see it is that accepting of these changes is important, and that I believe we should cherish the positive aspects of the lockdown, such as the family times, gardening, cleaning up your basement or your garage that we got to experience during these unprecedented times. And that's what I am doing.
And in just about 15 seconds, we did get a question from Ben on our Twitter account, which is at 21st Show, said, are we sure of the number of people who have had COVID-19? Would this not require an antibody test and true random sampling? And again, just in about 10 or 15 seconds, I wonder what your view is on that.
We are not sure of the exact numbers of the infected people because of the false negative rate of the current tests. That's why the models have some error allowance built.
All right, so we need better testing for that, it sounds like. All right, Olcay Akman is professor of mathematics at Illinois State University and directs the Center for Collaborative Studies in Mathematical Biology there. Professor Akman, thank you so much for speaking with us today on the 21st.
Thanks for the opportunity.
More to come after a short break. We're going to be talking about how to talk to your children about racism. That's just ahead on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. There is little doubt that we are in a pivotal moment as a country, as we not only confront racial injustice in policing, but also reevaluate and begin to dismantle the structures of systemic racism that exist in our society. One thing that's clear is the tremendous role and responsibility that younger generations are going to have in building that future of racial justice and equality. And in that lies a great responsibility with parents right now. How do we talk to our kids about race and all that's going on in America during this crucial moment? It's challenging, but it's also critically important right now. So joining us to talk about how, when, and why we must talk to our children about race and racism is Dr. Cynthia Langtu. She's professor of clinical psychology at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. Hello, Professor Langtu. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me. This is such an important conversation. I'm glad to be part of it.
Well, and we're really grateful that you could join us today. And we also want to invite parents, if you're listening, and we want you to join our conversation. How are you talking to your kids about race and racism in this moment? Or maybe if you're not sure how to, you have a question for our guest, Cynthia Langtu, give us a call. The number is 800-222-9455. That number again is 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. Professor Langtu, at what age do kids come into an understanding about the concept of race?
Yeah, that's such an important question. Thank you. And I love that you're not asking should, but you're asking how, because our kids know, our kids understand what's going on. And so research shows that as young as 3 and 4, that children start noticing phenotypic, so that's, you know, physical features of skin color difference. And that by 5 years old, though, by kindergarten, they have an internalized understanding of how the system works with respect to differences between different groups and that power differential between different groups. So they start noticing race really young, 3 and 4 years old differences, but they start noticing racism as a system at play with power differentials as young as kindergarten. So we should be having these conversations really early because they're having those conversations with themselves. And the earlier we can enter the conversations with them, the more that they'll come up with grounded ways of thinking about differences and how to manage those differences. So really young.
Yeah, and I wonder, can you describe how does a child, that's so fascinating, in kindergarten, how does a child perceive from, you know, to the best we can understand it and explain it, from a child's perspective, how does a child perceive racism in kindergarten?
Yeah, so it might be that, you know, if they've never had toys at their home where that, you know, represent the different hues, they might choose to play with certain toys and value, you know, toys that look like the toys at their home more than other toys, right? Hmm. And so that's one way that we notice in their play. You might notice that in classroom where there's a diversity of students, that students will tend to not only play, especially in kindergarten, with those who look like them, but with those who are the same gender as them. And so they notice a difference. And then there's the better, worse. So they come up with those ideas. And that's reflected in the larger system. So if they see on television or they see in spaces that certain people that look a certain way tend to be valued more, they'll live that out in their play, they'll live that out in their classroom, right? And so they'll place value on those who look like those that have value placed on them in the larger system. So that's how it looks, even that early.
And I just want to remind parents, our phone lines are open and the number to call is 800-222-9455. If you have a question for our guest, Professor Cynthia Langtu, who teaches clinical psychology at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology, or if you'd like to share maybe about how you're talking to your kids about racism during this crucial time, give us a call, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor, I recognize that conversations that Black parents and other parents of color may be having with their children about race is going to be different from the conversations that white parents may be having or should be having with their kids about race. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
I do. So I am a Black parent, you know, a daughter of Haitian immigrants. And I, you know, I have two boys who are 14, one will be 12 next week. And I think about the conversations around safety that I've had with them about Connect, and many other Black parents have had these conversations. And I think what's interesting is that when I talk to some of my non-Black friends about that, they're surprised that I would be concerned for the safety of my kids with respect to law enforcement or in other systems. But when I talk to my Black friends, there's no surprise. There's a sense that this is the kind of conversation that you have to have to keep your Black presenting voice safe. So there's that piece. And I would also say that for some of my non-Black friends, that there's a hesitation to have a conversation around race and racism because they're not sure what to say. So that's a big piece of it. So I would say across the board that as parents, it's really important for us to do our own work so that we enter the conversations that our kids are already having with themselves with curiosity and confidence, right? So for, you know, non-Black parents who are out there wondering, should I? Yes, you should. And if you're not sure, to go out and find resources about how, like, what do I say to them? How do I ask them questions? And it really is opening up the space for that. And I find that books and other resources, there's so many resources out there, and I can offer a couple that you can send out that offer ways to talk to your kids. But I would say it starts off with doing your own work. Knowing that this is an important topic to talk about, both race and racism, and opening up those spaces for your kids to be able to talk about them. And to talk about, I think the discomfort sometimes about talking about race and racism is that we don't want to scare our kids into thinking that there are people out to harm them and that are individually racist, and that may happen. But I think what's helpful sometimes is to talk about the system of racism, right, and one that's been created and one that so many, right, across movements are working to dismantle, right, so that people aren't hurt by the system of racism. and a system that's at work, and that system is unfair. And kids really get the idea of fairness, right? They really glom onto that. And so we can point out unfair situations that happen as a result of the system, and things that we as a family are doing that they can do, but that our larger larger work is being done around that. So those are some of the things that we can do to enter those conversations across the board. But it is a significant difference. Black parents have been having this conversation for a very long time. And I know many non-Black parents have as well, but many more families are having these conversations in light of the racial tensions that have arisen in the last couple of weeks. And I think that's a really important opportunity that we have before us.
Yeah, and we'd love to share out those resources on our website with this, when we post this conversation after the show. That's 21stshow.org. And also we'll tweet out some of those links that you're sharing with us at 21st Show. That's 21st Show. And, you mentioned this, and I also just want to direct our listeners, if they missed it, on Monday we had a conversation with the author of a book called White Fatigue about this, I think some of the ideas you were alluding to, white fragility, the sort of lack of confidence that sometimes people who are white, as I am, can have in these conversations about race, and therefore they just kind of choose to avoid them. I wonder if you can also talk about the different ages of kids. And I'm glad you mentioned the idea, because I think a lot of parents are also afraid of, they want to talk to kids about these concepts of injustice and privilege and acknowledge those realities, but they don't want to leave their children frightened. They want to leave them feeling empowered instead of scared and helpless. And I would imagine that this approach differs if you're talking about a 4-year-old versus an 8-year-old and a 12-year-old and a 16-year-old. And I wonder if you can talk about those differences.
Thank you for that question as well. So it does vary, across the lifespan. And I think wherever you start, so I think some parents might be saying, well, perhaps I should have started having my kid is 16. Perhaps I should have been having these conversations earlier. It's never too late to start, right? And I think the thing to remember is your child is already having that conversation with themselves. So wherever they are, find out where they are and meet them there. And so I would say there are resources. So Ibram Kendi just came out with a version of his book Stamped with Jason Reynolds. That is a book for young people around thinking about the system of racism. So how can you read that book together, with your 16-year-old? I think about the film 13th. That's a film that's available and accessible to, young people, as well as Howard Zinn's Young People's History of the U.S. So having these books around for some of our older children to read and for us to discuss together, those are important starting points. Finding out where they are developmentally and meeting them where they are. And so some of our younger, and the idea of fear is a really important one, right? They can feel like perhaps I'm at risk, right? And so, particularly for our kids, we're at home right now. It's easier to keep them at home. Letting them know that, as always, that you're going to do your best to help keep them safe, right? And that they are able to be safe. And the things that they're learning about these larger systems are ways of helping to keep other people safe as well. And so having the confidence yourself to be uncomfortable in having that conversation is really important. I think the other piece is presenting to them the struggles, that racism has caused people of color in the U.S. in particular, Black people in the U.S. in particular, but the fullness of humanity, that across time and space, that there's been everyday lives of Black folks, who have shined and blossomed. But then also that there have been non-Black folks across time and space who have always helped in the struggle along the way. And that there's been solidarity across movements. There's always been solidarity, and that there will continue to be solidarity. Also, that there is action that they can take now, right? In light of what's happened recently, children can go out and speak out about what they see as unfair. So if there's something in their classroom, they can speak out, go to the administration so you can teach them how to do that. If there's something that in their neighborhood that they see that's unfair, they can speak out on that level, or they can write a letter to you know, one of their congresspeople. So teaching them about the fullness of the humanity, that folks have struggled across time and space with respect to racism, but also have everyday lives that they've lived, right? And that there have been non-Black folks all along history that have helped and continue to help and can help, and that they can find their entree point anywhere along the way. And to help them manage, especially during this time, the uncertainty. And I think that we do that best as we model how to move through uncertainty and uncomfortable conversations with them, that we ourselves as parents are doing the work of sitting with our discomfort and moving through our discomfort so that we can model it for them, so that when we sit and talk to them about these issues and have conversations, that we are approaching it with curiosity and confidence.
This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Professor Cynthia Langtu, who is a professor of clinical psychology at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. Our phone lines are open, 800-222-9455. And there's only about 4 minutes left in our conversation and so much more to talk about here. I want to ask you about the issue of implicit bias, right? This is obviously a problem when it comes to race, and there are factors like our upbringings, what, you know, how we're socialized, what we're taught from our parents and teachers that inform that bias. And I wonder if you can talk about how much kids learn from their parents just by observation and being around them, and, you know, how we as parents can recognize and reverse that and try to prevent our children from developing it or picking up on biases we have that we may not even be aware of.
Yeah, wonderful question. Yes, our children pick up on our biases, and we all have them. You know, across the board, we have implicit biases, which means that there are ways that we are influenced by these larger systems of racism that we don't even recognize. So I think one way is to make sure that your children are exposed to lots of different people. And I know some of you who are listening don't live in very diverse areas, right? And so that can be difficult to do. So finding opportunities where you are able to, as families, meet different types of people and truly engage. Another level of that, right, is having books in your home, the media that you watch, being aware of what your children see and who they see represented, and in what roles those people are represented in all of the media to which they are exposed. And so, and then making sure that you have books in your home that really help speak to the struggles that people of color in particular have experienced around racism, but also the everyday joyful lives of people across different ethnic backgrounds and races, so that your children have a sense of the fullness of humanity. You know, there are lots of people who experience struggle. In the US, there's a specific struggle of Black people with respect to racism, but then Black people also have full lives, right? And all of our neighbors have full lives. And seeing that can be really helpful in adding to the story. So part of the challenge of implicit bias is it's strengthened by only having a singular perspective. And the more multiple perspectives that we have as a family and that we offer to our children, right, the less our implicit bias will be, the less their implicit bias will be. So exposure in so many different ways, right, can be really helpful.
And just briefly, and we've got only about 30 seconds left, but if there are parents out there who maybe want to involve their children in the ongoing protests against police brutality and racial injustice, do you have any advice?
I do. I would say that there's a really lovely book written by three psychologists, Something Happened in Our Town, A Child's Story About Racial Injustice. So I would say being specific about why they want to participate, what it is that they see, and helping them come up with strategies of how they're going to do it. So they're making the signs. They're coming up with the words that they want to use, but that you're having conversations with them as they use them, as they go into protest mode. Also, that there are many different ways to protest. Sure, being out last Saturday, there were tons of folks out protesting on the streets. And so parents can encourage their kids as a family to do that. But there are other ways too. You can protest by speaking out when you see an injustice at school. You can protest by speaking out and write a letter to a congressperson. You can protest by speaking out one-on-one with your friends. There are so many different levels. We can model that for our children, and we can go out there with them and support them as they speak.
And I'm afraid we have to leave it there. We will tweet out some of the resources you mentioned at 21st Show. Professor Cynthia Langtu of the Chicago School of Professional Psychology, thank you so much for being with us here on the 21st. More to come after a short break. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Over the past few months, many of us have relied on a third-party delivery service like Grubhub or DoorDash to enjoy our favorite food and support local businesses. But as more restaurants have turned to these delivery services to make ends meet, many have been left with a bad deal. Profit margins for full-service restaurants are usually around 3 to 5%. That's according to the restaurant software company Toast. But fees for these delivery apps are closer to 30%. Before the pandemic, many owners scoffed at the margins, but now they're left with few other options for actually serving customers. These companies have also come under fire for a lack of transparency around pricing. Last month, the city of Chicago implemented new rules that require third-party delivery services like Grubhub and DoorDash to give customers a breakdown of their purchase, including information on the commission or service fee a restaurant had to pay for the delivery. For more on this, I'm joined now by Ashok Selvam, who's senior editor at Eater Chicago. Ashok, welcome back to the 21st.
Great to be here. This is a topic that has a lot of restaurant owners fired up, and the pandemic has only made their frustrations even more apparent.
Okay. Well, that's great, because I would love to get into that. And also with us, we have Maureen Tessick, who is senior fellow at the American Economic Liberties Project. Maureen recently wrote about DoorDash and Grubhub for The Washington Post. Maureen Tessick, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me. My husband is also a chef, and I've been in the restaurant industry for years, so this is very close to my heart, this topic.
Okay, and we want to know what our listeners' experiences with these food delivery services. Have you been using Grubhub or DoorDash? You can join our conversation giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Maureen, I want to begin with you. How did the pandemic change the game for these third-party delivery apps?
Well, it made them the only game in town. So that was most full-service restaurants look at delivery and takeout business as incremental revenue. So for the same reason that they will, you know, let you buy 50-cent oysters during certain hours or a pre-theater menu before 6:30 and not really make a lot of money off that, they would deal with these extortionate fees because it was just gravy, really. What you're making your money on is the customer who sits down between, you know, 6:45 and 9 and orders a bottle or two of wine and some drinks and you know so that when the business shift to off-premise dining, suddenly all they had were these loss-making revenue opportunities. All restaurants right now are unprofitable, and it exacerbated that to the point of that it was just completely unsustainable.
It sounds like we have a little visitor on our program. that's more than
good. On his stroller. I'm just going to get him off really quick.
No, that's fine. I've got two little radio production assistants myself that I'm always in fear of bursting into my home studio as we're all working from home. So Ashok, I'm going to move to you. I wonder if you think that customers realize where their money is going when they pay their bills for Grubhub and Uber Eats and DoorDash, or even when they tip the driver.
Awareness has increased. increased thanks to the pandemic, if you want to look for a silver lining. But customers are just, they want their food fresh. They want their food quickly. They want their delivery driver to treat them with professionalism. So there's not a lot of accountability with these delivery services. And it's funny that you mentioned the city of Chicago's ordinance adapted last week to, or 2 weeks ago, I don't know where time goes anymore, but about the having to outline charges. There's not a lot of transparency, and the messaging is very tricky with these third-party services. And the city of Chicago tried to, you know, eliminate that and make it more transparent. So you're supposed to get a receipt that outlines the marketing fee, the service fee, so consumers actually know where their money is going. Unfortunately, the gripe du jour right now is that ordinance isn't being enforced, and the information on those receipts are still not clear. And this has been going on for a bit. But so do consumers know? No, they just, like, you know, it's that Apple slogan. It just has to work. And as long as they get that, they're going to be happy. But now the big thing is, during this pandemic, will those restaurants that they so treasure, will they exist? Will they be able to survive in this pandemic? And now once that goes with the 30 to 40%, whatever the take is by the delivery services, that's very much in jeopardy. And that's what's starting to kind of convince the consumer. And that's what we're, that's the reality of what you're in right now.
Yeah, and if you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Ashok Selvam, who's senior editor at Eater Chicago, and Maureen Tasek, who's a senior fellow at the American Economic Liberties Project. They've been talking about third-party delivery services like Grubhub and DoorDash and how they've turned out to be a bad deal for many restaurant owners. And we want to know what your experience is with food delivery services. You can join our conversation, 800-222-9455. Are you more aware now than you used to be? Are you tipping in cash maybe instead of through the app? Give us a call, 800-222-9455. And Maureen Tasek, can you tell us more about the Chicago Pizza Boss and what they told you about their relationship with Grubhub? Let's break down some of these fees that they're paying.
Well, sure. So the Chicago Pizza Boss is this gentleman named Giuseppe who used to have a food truck called Chicago Pizza Boss. He has some kids. He decided that he was done with the food truck and he started a pizza consultancy. So he has a few clients. There are pizzerias. Pizza is generally a pretty high margin thing to sell. It's one of the few things you can actually make some money selling. So, you know, there's a lot of room for consultancy in that business. He had a client and he got so angry when he saw this client's Grubhub invoice that he posted it on Facebook and it went totally viral. It was just over $1,000 that the in total sales and gross sales that this pizzeria had done through Grubhub. And Grubhub had extracted 666 in fees. Now, 95.
I gotta say, just the number there is like a little ironic, I guess. 666.
Yeah, exactly, right? No, it's truly satanic. So $95 of that was delivery, the delivery service. That's what they were charging. That's all the big reason anyone signs up with one of these apps is to get delivery service. Well, only $95 of the 666 was earmarked for delivery. $206.51 was earmarked for commission. So that's just the price of admission to the app, to the program being on their platform. $231 was promotions. And that is where it gets very deceptive. You sign up for a little bit of extra marketing oomph from Grubhub. It's sort of the cost of not getting buried in the searches, getting, you know, when somebody searches for pizza being on one of the top five choices that they advertise. But you have to, you know, sometimes you'll have to give, you know, $7 off or something like that. So that's how much it costs to kind of play in that territory. $131 was order adjustments. And another place where that gets very tricky is that almost all of the time, the mess ups are the result of the delivery driver, the app not working correctly. And they are very quick to to refund a customer who's unhappy with their experience. And I think a quarter, more than a quarter of transactions with delivery apps are unsatisfying to customers. Polls have shown that. So it's an enormous percentage of unsatisfied customers that are produced by these transactions, and they just get charged to the restaurant. So that's another way that this restaurant was totally just victimized by Grubhub.
I wonder if you can. This is not the first time that third-party delivery services have come under fire from restaurant owners, right? Can you talk about some of the past issues that have surfaced?
Sure. It all brings them. So all of the things that they've gotten in trouble with before are the things that have put them in the position of being able to extract all these fees from all these restaurants. And those are things that they have done with Silicon Valley subsidies, basically. Because remember, none of these delivery apps are profitable. They have lost billions and billions of dollars. And restaurants can't afford to lose billions and billions of dollars. But that is the Silicon Valley model. It's called disruption. They call it disruption, but what it really is trying to put these platforms in the position to get some sort of, create some sort of monopoly. So when they've been in trouble before, it was for first holding themselves out as being the partners of well-loved food brands, In-N-Out Burger and Illegal Seafoods, actually sued DoorDash because DoorDash was using all of their brand materials and their logos to kind of make it out that DoorDash was an official partner of these restaurants, which they weren't. But that kind of helps them grow their base. The other thing that they've gotten in trouble for is for creating dummy websites, for cyber squatting on restaurants. When they're going to target a market, they'll do a little bit of market study of all the restaurants in the area, and they would just acquire en masse URLs related to the restaurants in that area. And then they would kind of start to create, they would scour the internet for menu information and create websites mm-hmm. that they would then juice up in the search rankings that would give users the idea that these were those restaurant websites, but they would always direct the traffic back to Grubhub or DoorDash. It was a DoorDash subsidiary that was also very involved in doing this, because it's done this with tens of thousands of restaurants.
Yeah.
And what it's done is it's directed a lot of, if you have a favorite restaurant, you want to order delivery, chances are you're being directed back to one of these services.
Basically, I guess, duping buyers into thinking that they're calling the restaurant. And we've only got a couple of minutes left. And Ashok Selvam with Eater Chicago, I wonder, here in Illinois, outdoor dining is opening back up. Do you think we'll see business drop the delivery services because it seems to be a bad deal? Or are customers more used to this home delivery thing and they're going to kind of, businesses will be forced to keep it?
Well, restaurant owners are already adapting to the guidelines that each municipality is handing out. There's a state and on the local level. And then if you're going to ask them to what they should be doing on the delivery side, that's asking them a lot right now. So I think the consumer's confidence, right, if they're not ready to go out, no matter what, restaurant owners want to say, you know, they wouldn't have the right to make money. There's still a lot of anxiety over, over the coronavirus. So there's going to be a focus on delivery and takeout. I know that's what we're doing at Eater Chicago. We can't really recommend you to go out with good faith because I don't know your comfort level. I had a big talk with my wife about it. We're like, are we going to be eating out? Are we going to go on the patio? And it just depends. There's so many variables. There's been some talk with restaurant owners when hopefully things settle down right now. Perhaps they'll band together and create their own delivery fleets, their own websites to get around these delivery services. I know there's a Chicago-based Grubhub is the target of a lot. And obviously yesterday there's that news that they've been sold to a Dutch company, and we'll see if they're still going to be Chicago's very own after this. There's a lot of unknowns And with this, I don't know what delivery is going to look like. I don't know what outdoor dining is going to look like. We had a couple of crowded patios last weekend, and then the city came out and made sure that the tables were 6 feet apart, because there were a lot of complaints by folks that are saying, hey, this is very boisterous. I don't like this. I'm afraid. Yeah. So that's still being determined. So there's so much out there. We got to wait. We got to wait on that. And then there's delivery fees. Like Chicago's still wondering about putting a cap on that. So that's going to affect things as well.
Yeah, and we're going to have to leave it there. And I will say the Mackey household is still living in phase two, not going out to restaurants. We just got our first takeout pizza for the first time in 3 months. So that was Ashok Selvam, senior editor at Eater Chicago. We've also been speaking with Maureen Tessick, senior fellow at the American Economic Liberties Project, who has written about these issues. Thank you both so much for being with us on the 21st. And that is unfortunately all the time we have for this week. Our program is produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Ryan Wild. Our intern is Zaini Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director, and I am Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.